that by 1890, the first International Workers' Day for Unity and Solidarity was declared. The holiday is celebrated in scores of countries and often called Labor Day, but most English-language countries celebrate their own Labor Day in autumn.
This is a day where we're connecting lots of struggles that are important to the workers' movement, right? Immigrants' rights, the defunding the police, the Black Lives Matter explosion of the last year, right? The uprising has shown that there is really a fighting mood within the U.S., the workers' movement in general.
Many 19th century struggles are still being fought today, such as against the privileges and parasitism created by monarchies. New U.S. President Joe Biden just rejected a $15 per hour minimum wage, even though wages haven't been hiked since 2009 and non-governmental estimates of inflation are 10% annually. Businesses like Amazon are dubbed innovation heroes in the mainstream media, yet are notorious for grueling working conditions. Many marching on May Day also oppose Western liberal democracy, which is often accused of creating and protecting a new aristocracy on the backs of the average worker. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. India's Prime Minister suffered a rare political defeat in a key state election amid signs of a voter backlash over his handling of the coronavirus disaster as the country reported a record number of deaths. Narendra Modi, India's Prime Minister, had been expected to make significant gains on Sunday, 2nd of May, in West Bengal, one of few states where his right-wing Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, does not have a parliamentary majority. Instead, Mamata Banerjee, a powerful regional politician and prominent Modi critic, won a third term as chief minister. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Hannah Ellis-Peterson and Luke Harding. The piece is titled, Narendra Modi Loses Key State Election as COVID Grips India. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has suffered a rare political defeat in a key state election amid signs of a voter backlash over his handling of the coronavirus disaster, as the country reported a record number of deaths. Modi had been expected to make significant gains on Sunday, 2nd of May, in West Bengal, one of few states where his right-wing Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, does not have a parliamentary majority. Instead, Mamata Banerjee, a powerful regional politician and prominent Narendra Modi critic, won a third term as chief minister in West Bengal. Banerjee's All India Trinamool Congress won a comfortable majority, clocking up 216 seats in the 294-seat assembly. The BJP won 75 seats, up on its performance in 2016 when it got just 3 seats, but well short of predictions. Narendra Modi made dozens of speeches on the campaign trail in West Bengal, together with his Home Minister Amit Shah, who visited as recently as last weekend. Both have been accused of prioritizing politics over the response to the COVID-19 pandemic. On Sunday, 2nd of May, India's new coronavirus cases fell slightly, but there were a record 3,689 new deaths. Grim scenes continue to unfold, with people dying in hospital corridors, on roads, and in their homes. Car parks have been turned into cremation grounds, while desperate families scramble to find medicines and oxygen. Indian authorities reported 392,488 new cases, with the total now at 19.56 million. The coronavirus has killed 215,542 people in India, according to official figures. The actual death toll is estimated to be 2 to 5 times this figure. The United Kingdom has said it will step up its help to the Indian government by providing a further 1,000 ventilators for use in Indian hospitals, although there was no sign it planned to send any more vaccines to India. Up to 10 Indian states and union territories have imposed some form of restrictions on people's movement. The federal government in India and New Delhi, however, remains reluctant to impose a national lockdown, citing the damage this will do to India's economy, which shrank dramatically last year. Despite warnings from scientists of a looming second wave of coronavirus infections in India, Narendra Modi addressed large rallies in West Bengal throughout February and March. He refused to wear a face mask, and there was little sign of social distancing. His decision to turn a blind eye to the rising infection rate was fueled by an apparent desperation to win the state. In recent weeks, he took up all the government's attention. The election was the most drawn out in West Bengal's history, conducted in 8 phases over a month. The Election Commission, in effect controlled by the BJP, refused early requests from opposition political parties to shrink the poll into a shorter period and to make campaigning virtual. In the state capital, Calcutta, the proportion of COVID tests results that are positive has reached 50%, according to some laboratories. Narendra Modi's failure to seize West Bengal can be seen in part as a response to his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. But voters also rejected the BJP's divisive anti-Muslim politics in Bengal, which was the main thrust of its campaign. It is testament, too, to the enduring popularity of Banerjee, India's only female chief minister in power since 2011 and a target of repeated Narendra Modi attacks. The BJP is not an unstoppable force. It can be defeated by a strong-rooted regional leader, the columnist Swati Chaturvedi wrote on Sunday. The political pendulum is now swinging away from the BJP. The awful central handling of the vicious second wave of COVID-19 and its tragic oxygen shortage will cost Narendra Modi. Vinay Sitapati, an assistant professor of political science at Ashoka University, said, had the BJP won Bengal, it would have spun as validation of their nationwide COVID approach. We should not make the opposition mistake. The Bengal loss is because of a combination of long-standing local factors. He predicted regional leaders and an eventual patchwork of parties rather than a weakened Congress party would now take on Narendra Modi nationally. Votes are being counted in several other Indian states, including Assam, Tamil Nadu, Kerala, and Puducherry. The BJP was on track to keep Assam. In Kerala, the left-wing chief minister, Pinarayi Vijayan, was re-elected, an unprecedented feat for an incumbent. Most of the votes in the state elections were cast in March, but polling in some constituencies continued throughout April, just as Indians started detecting thousands of fresh coronavirus infections every day. Last Saturday, new cases reached a record daily high of 401,993. Narendra Modi's government has been criticized for letting millions of largely unmasked people attend the religious festivals and crowded political rallies in five states throughout the months of March and April. Daily cases in three states have surged since then. Over the weekend, Reuters reported that the federal government had been accused of failing to respond to warning from scientific advisers in early March that a new and more contagious COVID-19 variant was taking hold in India.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
People who limit the Quran to worshipping and personal matters haven't understood it. This is a part of a speech delivered on April 14, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, at the annual Ramadan Quranic meeting. The speech was delivered via video conference with the participation of a number of prominent Quranic reciters.
All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, and may God curse all their enemies. I hope that by Allah's favor, this auspicious month will be a joyous and blessed occasion for our nation and for the great Islamic Ummah, in the real sense of the word. I thank the dear brothers who organized this very good and innovative meeting with diverse programs. I thank all the dear brothers who recited the Quran and who really brought us joy. I'm also pleased about the evoked memories of the past, and I hope that as Allah the Exalted has helped us live our life in the company of the Quran over the course of all these years, He will help us serve the Quran and be in its company until the last breath, that He will let us live and die with the Quran, and that He will associate us with the Quran, God willing. لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان 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 يا حبيب رمضان رمضان
ليتك دوما قريب.
As for Quranic guidance, notice that Allah the Exalted mentions the sending down of the Quran as one of the many advantages of the month of Ramadan. Ramadan is the month in which was sent down the Quran. It is evident that this is the most important advantage of the month of Ramadan. As for the Quran itself, there are thousands of outstanding points in it, much more than our minds can understand fully. Among all Quranic subject matters, the Quran highlights Quranic guidance. Ramadan is the month in which was sent down the Quran as a guide to mankind, also clear signs for guidance and judgment. The Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse 185. Evidently, Quranic guidance has a lofty position among all Quranic subject matters. As it happens, the Quran begins with the issue of guidance. This can be seen in Surah Al-Hamd, "Show us the straight path." As the late Allama Tabatabai, may God bestow paradise on him, mentioned, Surah Al-Hamd teaches us how to address God from start to finish.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration's weapons sales to the UAE is a disastrous move. It puts the U.S. squarely on the side of a serial human rights abuser and inflames a region already awash with way too many weapons. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Miriam Benjamin and Ariel Gold, anti-war activists. This article is published under the heading, Why is Biden selling weapons to a country that helped make Yemen a hell hole? Stay tuned for more. The Biden administration's recent announcement giving a green light to a massive $23 billion weapons sales to the United Arab Emirates makes a mockery of its commitment to put human rights at the forefront of its foreign policy. The Emirates' disastrous roles in Yemen and Libya, along with its vicious human rights record at home, should disqualify it from acquiring advanced weapons. The deal was negotiated under the Trump administration and came to light less than a week after Donald Trump announced the normalization of relations between the Zionist regime and the UAE, known as the Abraham Accords. While the public was diverted with Trump's supposedly brilliant peace initiative, the secret clause that sweetened the deal was leaked. The U.S. would sell billions of dollars of weapons to the Persian Gulf state, 50 F-35 fighter jets, 18 Reaper drones and various missiles, bombs, and munitions. The UAE and the Zionist regime have never been at war and had maintained unofficial ties for years, but the peace accord allowed the Trump administration to circumvent a policy that requires the United States to guarantee the Israeli regime's military superiority in the region. The Zionist regime's Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu initially feigned outrage that another West Asian country besides the regime would possess the high-tech F-35, but it was soon revealed that the Prime Minister had been in the know from the start and had approved the deal with his own caveat. The Israeli regime would get additional U.S. weapons to balance those going to the UAE. Congressional opponents of the arms deal responded by introducing a bipartisan resolution of disapproval to block the sale. Surprisingly, hawkish Senator Bob Menendez, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, led the resolution with Senators Chris Murphy and Ron Paul. They cited concerns about the timing as a rushed end run around Congress, the UAE's troubling involvement in Yemen and Libya. Though their legislation was voted down when Joe Biden came into office, the State Department put this sale as well as a weapons deal Trump had negotiated with Saudi Arabia on hold. Human rights groups were encouraged that the Biden review might lead to a quashing of the deal, but apparently, geopolitical pressures, the hawks in the administration, and pressure from the weapons lobby have won the day. The companies that stand to gain hefty profits from this sale include Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, General Atomics, and Northrop Grumman. Lockheed Martin will get $10.4 billion selling 50 of its F-35s. According to the New York Times, Raytheon, the biggest supplier of the bombs, lobbied the Trump administration for the deal. Trump's Secretary of Defense Mike Esper was a lobbyist for Raytheon, and Biden's Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is a former Raytheon board member. The UAE's role in Yemen should have been enough to quash the deal. For the past 6 years, the U.S.-supported coalition led by Saudi Arabia has been waging a war in Yemen so brutal that, according to David Beasley, executive director of the World Food Program, this war-torn nation is hell on earth, where one Yemeni child dies every 75 seconds. In 2017, Human Rights Watch and Associated Press accused the UAE of operating secret prisons in Yemen where prisoners were subjected to horrific forms of torture. Former inmates described cramped conditions covered in feces, being beaten, sexually assaulted, and trussed up on a grill. "We could hear the screams," said a former detainee held for 6 months at the Rayyan airport. "The entire place is gripped by fear. Almost everyone is sick. The rest are near death. anyone who complains heads directly to the torture chamber, said one former detainee. In addition to its direct involvement, the UAE supported local proxies, around 90,000 fighters, providing them with direct training, capacity building, logistic assistance, and salaries. It also brought in mercenaries from as far away as Colombia, and weapons sold to the UAE ended up in the hands of Al-Qaeda terrorists inside Yemen. Complaints have been filed in the courts in the UK and the US alleging that UAE mercenaries in Yemen committed human rights abuses and war crimes. They also allege that the UAE joined the Saudis in enforcing a naval blockade that has kept fuel, food, and medicines from people in need, committing over 30 fighter jets to carry out airstrikes and naval ships to enforce the coalition's blockade. Anxious to get out of a losing war that has been so bad for its image, the Emirates held a ceremony on February 9, 2020, to mark the end of their involvement in the Yemeni war, moving from a military-first strategy to a peace-first strategy. But humanitarian groups on the ground tell us that the UAE maintains a presence in Saqqarah, Mokalla, and a small presence in Yemen. In addition, it offers financial and military support to a variety of armed groups and political movements that have had a destabilizing influence throughout the country, particularly in the south. Another strike against the sale is that it is fueling the West Asia arms race. While the UAE is set to become the first Arab state to acquire F-35s, it will not be the last. Qatar has already asked to purchase them, and Saudi Arabia will likely follow. The Israeli regime is expecting additional arms beyond the $3.8 billion they already receive annually from the U.S. in military assistance. A final reason is to oppose the deal is the UAE domestic situation. Prince Mohammed bin Zayed is a shrewd West Asian dictator who uses his country's military and financial resources to thwart moves toward democracy and respect for human rights under the guise of fighting terrorism. The UAE restricts freedom of expression and silences dissent. According to Amnesty International, in 2020, despite the COVID-19 pandemic, the UAE continued to detain dozens of prisoners of conscience, including prominent human rights defender Ahmed Mansour. The government keeps opponents under arbitrary detention, and a number of prisoners remain incarcerated despite having completed their sentences. On April 15, 2021, a cross-party coalition of European parliamentarians condemned the systematic crackdown on freedom of speech and expression and called for the release of all prisoners of conscience and an end to torture and ill treatment of these prisoners and the protection of prisoners' families from collective punishment. Another group subject to all kinds of abuses are the millions of migrants who work in Emirates under the kafala system, a type of visa sponsorship system which deprives workers of basic rights. Faced with domestic crises that include a pandemic, a battered economy, and exploding racial tensions, President Biden understands the need to focus his attention on domestic issues and wind down U.S. military entanglements from the past two decades. His recent announcement that U.S. troops will leave Afghanistan by September 11, 2021, reflects this. A $23 billion weapon sales to the UAE is a disastrous move in the Biden administration. It puts the U.S. squarely on the side of a serial human rights abuser and inflames a region already awash with way too many weapons. A new round of legislation by Senators Menendez and Feinstein is being introduced to put checks on the sale of F-35s, but it is the entire sale that must be questioned. If Biden refuses to put domestic and human rights concerns ahead of the profits of weapons manufacturers, then Congress must step and pass legislation to stop it.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Seeing the beatings, vandalism, and detentions in Colombia these days, human rights groups have condemned the police's heavy-handed tactics against rallyers. It's said that 19 civilians have lost their lives and over 800 people have been wounded. The rallies are still underway, despite the government's announcement of reviewing a tax reform package that has sparked the protests. It seems that the demonstrations are not going to stop as people and unions are raising more demands. So what's next in Colombia? Will the Duque administration stop the crackdown and instead heed the people's demands? Okay, to discuss those questions, I'm joined by our guests in tonight's debate show. We'll have journalists with the Behind the Headlines, Dan Cohen, who's joining us out of Washington, D.C., and also journalist and political analyst, Ali Vargas from Cochabamba in Bolivia. Good to have you both on the show. Let's go to Dan first. The concession by Duque's government, Dan, to backpedal on a proposed tax reform has done little to calm the protesters' anger. Why is that?
Well, Duque's announcement was little more than an attempt to trick the population into stopping the protests. When Duque announced that he would withdraw it, he also said that he would announce another proposal in the next few days and that it was absolutely necessary. And this trick failed. The protests have only grown, and the demands have continued to add up, because Colombia is a country in absolute crisis, where 43% of the population is in poverty and 15% is in extreme poverty, and the government is attempting to force these tax reforms throat of the public, and it's being rejected.
Okay, Ali, popular anger goes beyond the tax reform, and protesters are demanding much more than the withdrawal of the tax reforms only. So what are the other things that the protesters asking for?
Well, Colombia is going through a very similar crisis to another South American country, Peru, and that is that Colombia historically and currently, of course, has a free market economic model that delivered growth for the 1% and crumbs for the vast majority of people. And sort of a mix of propaganda, repression has managed to keep sort of social unrest at bay, or at least repress it when it does come out. However, the pandemic has seen that social setup, that system, really crumble. Because, and I think the tax reform that they're trying to push through is a symbol of that. Because with the pandemic and with the lockdown having destroyed the country's tax base, as businesses close down, people fall out of formal employment. So their solution, now that the government doesn't have enough revenue, is to tax the general population, raise taxes on the general population. Mm-hmm. And they have to do this because Colombia is a country that doesn't have big state industries that can provide it with revenue to have the funds that it needs to satisfy basic demands of ordinary people, particularly at a time like this. So we've seen people lose faith in the system that Colombia has had for decades under, you know, and has maintained with an iron fist. So people's demands are against inequality, are against the narco violence that emanates from the states and from pro-state paramilitary groups. That's been a tactic that, you know, used to repress social protests for a long time, and people finally had enough. So it's a general uprising. It's not about one policy. This policy was, of course, the trigger for the reasons that I explained, but this is a much wider rebellion.
Okay. Now, Dan, as you may know, Colombia is one of the countries with the largest debts in the world, and how is this affecting its domestic politics and the pressure that the government is facing in order to balance its finances?
Well, there's no doubt that the Colombian government is beholden to international capital and the neoliberal economic system. And this tax reform is essentially to please international capital. So investors see Colombia as a sort of stable market. Now, that stability comes at the price of stability and security for working class, for middle class, for poor people. So, you know, this constant instability that that Colombians suffer, well, the government has tried to kind of keep a lid on it, as Ali explained, and has been pretty successful for a long time. But attempting to force, you know, this new tax reform, this increase in taxes on the country has backfired massively. And, you know, I think the government is, it has no answer other than to use brute force to kill protesters. It's not even clear how many protesters have been killed at this point. I actually spoke to a journalist, Laura Sofia Mejia, about a press agency in Pereira, Colombia today, who told me that the highest levels of the government have given an order for the hospitals to not report the number of deaths and injuries. So it's only up to the journalists to go through the hospitals and the emergency rooms and count how many deaths there have been. So there's no real count, and I think it's safe to assume that it's much higher than the 19 or 20 that have been reported so far. So Colombia is in absolute crisis purely because of the financial system that its ruling class uses.
Now, let me ask you this. People have concerns about police violence and also human rights situation. So how serious are these concerns?
Well, it's extremely serious. Colombia is one of the most violent countries in the Americas, and the massacres that just taken place in the city of Cali is the 35th massacre of this year, of 2021. The vast majority of massacres that take place on a weekly basis in Colombia, on a more than weekly basis, predominantly take place in rural areas against union leaders, rural workers, leaders, indigenous leaders, ex-FARC combatants. So the violence has been ongoing and permanent. I mean, just last year, 2020, there was over 90 massacres. So, you know, Colombia is looking on course to at least match the level of violence that the country saw last year. And it's something that's obviously not reported on in international media in any systematic way. And even now, we see the same thing. We see Latin America correspondents for the big newspapers be completely silent on this issue, including the South America bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, someone who lives in Colombia and has not written any articles about it. He hasn't even posted anything on Twitter about it, something that's taking place in his own country, because this is something that's severely embarrassing for a key U.S. ally. And Colombia is a key U.S. ally for a number of reasons, as the largest number of U.S. military bases in the region, in South America. And it's a key player in destabilizing other countries, destabilizing, for example, Venezuela, reinforcing the U.S. attacks on Venezuela. So I think these are all things that we have to take together. And when, you know, the United States is not going to let one of their key allies go quietly. I think while we have silence at the moment, we may see a propaganda machine kicking in to try and defend the current government and its human rights violations.
Dan, let's now take a look at Duque's presidency and his performance. Critics are saying that his presidency is marked by incompetence, and also some others are saying that also neglecting the voices of dissent. How would you size up his performance as president?
I think those are very fair opinions of the Duque government. I mean, since day one, he's been unpopular, incompetent, as you said, and basically a puppet of the kingmaker politician in Colombia, former President Álvaro Uribe, who is the U.S. has known for many years is essentially a drug trafficker. And actually, Duque's presidency was bought and paid for by drug traffickers themselves. There was a major scandal that was completely ignored in the U.S. press called Ñeñe Política, in which a powerful drug trafficker named Ñeñe Hernández was found to be buying votes for Iván Duque, and this was ordered by Álvaro Uribe, the former president and top U.S. ally. So it's more than incompetence. This is a complete narco state. It's been that way for decades, and under the presidency of first Álvaro Uribe and now Iván Duque, the power of the drug trafficking cartels, as well as the below board and the above board international cartels, have complete power. And so, they're not going to give that up without an extreme bloodbath, and that's what we're seeing today.
Now, Oli, let's take a look back. I want you to please bring us up to speed about the developments that Colombia has experienced after the peace deal in 2016. And, that ended 50 years of fighting between the FARC rebel group and the government. So what is the security situation like in the country 5 years after this deal?
Yeah, that's right. The 2016 peace accords ended the longest civil war in human history. But I think for a lot of people, that civil war is still ongoing. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there's massacres on two to three massacres every week in Colombia, predominantly in rural areas where there used to be FARC insurgencies. And even though the FARC, now they are called the Communist Party, even though they handed in their weapons, they agreed to relinquish the territory they held, and they agreed to enter formal politics as a peaceful political group committed to an electoral path towards social change that they demand. Despite all of those steps taken by one side of those who signed the peace deal, the FARC, the armed insurgency, that hasn't been respected by the state nor the paramilitary groups that often fight alongside them. So that state, the military, these paramilitary groups, they continue to assassinate, ex-FARC combatants, people who handed in their weapons, and people whose names are on those 2016 peace accords. So for those people, for the hundreds of people who signed that peace treaty but have since been killed in that time, the civil war certainly didn't end for them. And of course, there's a wider war against the population. The wider population is being waged now. Now that we have blood rain through the streets of urban areas, normally restricted to the rural areas of the country. So it's all coming to a crisis point, and precisely because of the economic issue that I mentioned at the beginning. So countries, for example, like Bolivia, that have large nationalized industries that provide most of the government revenue that the state uses to pay for its functions, Colombia doesn't have that. Colombia has a free market model. So when the tax base collapses during lockdown, if they don't have big state assets like countries like Bolivia have. So it's a problem of a wider economic free market model that wasn't built to sustain the sorts of blows that the pandemic has dealt the country. And it's the same immediate cause of the internal political crisis in Peru. The system that was raised and that has shown up as an example of democratic neoliberalism crumpled upon impact when the pandemic hit, and the state and the free market model was exposed to something that wasn't able to take its blows, wasn't able to provide for ordinary people that suffered economically, and has left the state without the resources to rebuild the economy.
Dan, as you know, protesters are also angry at the lack of a social safety net during the pandemic. So what has been the impact of the pandemic on Colombia's economy, and how would you evaluate the government's response to the pandemic's economic and social impacts?
Well, even prior to the pandemic, Colombia was in a terrible situation financially with large swaths of the country in poverty and also in extreme poverty. And as Ollie explained so clearly, the pandemic has only exacerbated these problems. As I said before, the poverty is now at 43% of the country. That's nearly half of the people are impoverished, and 15% are in extreme poverty. People are not able to buy basic foods. They don't have their basic needs met. They can't eat. They can't buy medicine. So this has come to a breaking point now, and the pandemic has been completely mismanaged in the most extreme way. I see New York Times articles criticizing Venezuela for its handling of the pandemic when Colombia has been multitudes worse. There are millions and millions of cases of COVID-19 in Colombia, and that's never really touched on in mainstream media in the U.S. It's always about Venezuela, as with all other issues. So Colombia has been, mismanaged is an understatement. Been so severe, it has made this kind of reckoning inevitable. And sadly, now the government, after mismanaging the economy and the pandemic in such a terrible way, has now decided that it will murder basically anyone who rises up against it.
Ollie, the way that the government has handled the protests has drawn the ire of both the Colombian people and the international community and rights organizations. They're all calling for an end to this crackdown. And some believe that police reform is a must. Let's have your opinion on that.
Well, the entire international community hasn't come together to condemn this sort of violence. The notable people who have been notably silent include the Organization of American States and their secretary, Luis Almagro, someone who holds conferences, events on an almost weekly basis about Venezuela or Nicaragua or some other country. There's been silence from the United States, of course. The United States wasn't so silent when Bolivia arrested former dictator Hernán Áñez, but they have been a lot more silent when it comes to the executions in the streets of the urban Colombia. Also notable, as I mentioned earlier, notable in their silence has been the international media, Western correspondents working for outlets such as the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, have also been extremely silent about what's going on. So it's from those sectors, the sorts of sectors that the Colombian middle and upper class depend on for their own power, it's those sectors that have been silent about this and have refused to join the chorus of condemnation about what's going on Colombia. So I think it'll be interesting to see how this develops, because the protests are not going away. The anger that people have is about structural reasons. So I don't think one move or another policy change is going to quell that. So if we see more repression, it'll be interesting to see if more international actors decide to express solidarity with the Colombian people who are living an a moment of extreme authoritarianism right across the country, with cities completely militarized and the ongoing violence in the country's rural areas.
Now, Dan, the government insists that a tax reform is needed to stabilize the country already ravaged by the pandemic, but middle-class people are complaining that the reform pressures them and favors the rich only. Let's have your comment.
the government has really put itself in a difficult position because it's completely beholden to international capital. It's in quite a bit of debt. And so in order to keep international capital and investors happy, it essentially does have to do this. And so the government has just put itself in this position where it's essentially has to force this tax reform down the throats of the Colombian people, and the Colombian people simply can't take it. The poverty is already too extreme. They're asking far too much. A 19% increase, I believe, on public transportation. It's just too much for people, and so now it's playing out in the streets where it's, this contradiction it's one. These are just two incompatible forces, and so unless the government changes its policy or finds another way to satisfy these investors, then it's hard to see how this resolves. So, okay.
All right, Ali. What about the U.S.? It was mentioned that U.S. Is an ally. So there have been no reaction regarding all this crackdown and people's demands and the government's heavy-handed tactics against them.
No, and particularly people like Secretary of State Antony Blinken, which is someone who's normally so quick to condemn Latin American countries who don't toe the line of the U.S. Yeah, as I said earlier, there has been a general silence from the most powerful sectors that helped prop up the current Colombian regime. And Colombia is a country as well that produces well over 90% of the cocaine that reaches the United States, Peru producing most of the rest. And yet we see communiques all the time on a monthly basis from Secretary of State Antony Blinken and from the institution.
Looks like we have a problem with that. One quick question, Dan. What's the way out of this situation in Colombia? Cabinet reshuffle, national dialogue, or what? 30 seconds, please.
Without the government fully withdrawing this tax proposal, there's no way that these protests will die down. As we said at the beginning of the segment, the demands have only added, and there are so many issues that have been piled on top of the government is not only, but intentionally basically attacked all sectors of the country. So it's really hard to see how Duque comes out of this, and we could even see the downfall of Duque.
Okay. All right, and then we'll come to the end of this debate.